This is the Peoria Reads Don't Shoot Roundtable series on 89.9 WCBU. I'm Peoria Public Radio News Director Tanya Kuntz. This is the third of a four-part series. We're talking about David Kennedy's book Don't Shoot and the Peoria Initiative. For the next hour, Peoria Mayor Jim Artis, Peoria County State's Attorney Jerry Brady, U.S. Attorney Jim Lewis, and Peoria Police Chief Steve Settingsguard are talking about David Kennedy's strategy to end gun violence and reviewing the third quarter of the book, specifically as it relates to violent crime in Peoria. Later in the program, the panel is speaking with U.S. Attorney Rob Lang from High Point, North Carolina, and Ed McGirrell, Director of the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University. But first, the panel reviews this week's reading, Peoria Mayor Jim Artis.
Well, we'd like to thank everyone for joining us again for the third week of the Peoria Reads Don't Shoot project. We're joined again this week by our panelists that consist of our state's attorney, Jerry Brady, our United States attorney, Jim Lewis, our sheriff, Mike McCoy, our police chief, Steve Settingsguard, and I'm Mayor Jim Artis. So this week we're reading three chapters, which are the heart of David Kennedy's book, Don't Shoot, and these chapters deal with the impact of the implementation of the strategy on racial issues, the expansion of the program to address drug dealing, and taking the strategy to other sites across the nation. This week we're also, joined by two national guests. Ed McCarroll is one of the leading experts on focused deterrence strategy in the nation. And for those of you who have been reading along with us, keep in mind there's those two words, focused deterrence, again, that we will continue to allude to in the importance of the focused deterrence strategy. Mr. McGarrell will join us and discuss what makes the strategy work and what are some of the factors that can lead to the strategy not working. And also this week we're joined by Rob Lang, who's an assistant U.S. attorney from the Middle District of North Carolina, which was the first place that David Kennedy's focused deterrence strategy was expanded for use against drug markets. So we're going to start off today by talking about the chapters that we read for this week. Jerry Brady's our state's attorney here in Peoria. And Jerry, maybe you can just start off this week by giving us an overview of the chapter entitled Across the Race Divide.
Morning, Mayor. I'll be glad to. And I think probably one of the aspects that struck me the most in reading the book about Across the Race Divide was that there was not an intention when the program was put together by David Kennedy that it would have impact on race relations, but it did. As a matter of fact, after the program was implemented, there was a great improvement between the police and the community and the police in terms of race relations. So although it wasn't one of the goals of the program, it turned out, and in my opinion, may have been one of the best goals of the program because it solved some of the racial problems in the community. When Kennedy designed the focused deterrence strategy for use against violent gangs, he had one goal in mind, and that we know was stopping the gun violence. But when the strategy worked, something else happened, and that's what struck me as so important, that he didn't expect or he didn't predict, and that was the relationships between the police and the minority community improved drastically and dramatically. At first, Kennedy was at a loss. He couldn't understand how to explain that, but it was clearly happening, but it was what would be an unintended consequence, and he couldn't really explain why. What Kennedy found was that by implementing the focused deterrence strategy, that it destroyed the old ways the police view the community and how the community views the police. So you see a different awareness of how the police view the community and simultaneously as well how the community then views the police. After generations of dealing with offenders in the minority community, some in the police community mistakenly believe that the community does not care, and I can understand that. With years dealing with offenders, that you know you tend to lose your enthusiasm, and you become beat down sometimes as police officers. And so they mistakenly believe the community really doesn't care, when in reality the community does care. After generations of being subject to aggressive police measures designed to stop the violence and other criminal conduct, many in the minority community mistakenly believed that the police did not care about them. And I want to focus, you know, I want to stress mistakenly, because police are all intending good people that care about the community. But the community sometimes, as we all do in society, you know, we mistakenly view something, and we're wrong at times. I myself can be wrong, but we mistakenly can view whether or not the community cared about and how they viewed the police. The forging of the partnerships between the community, the moral voice of the community, and the police in order to implement the focused deterrent strategy broke down those walls, which is what I alluded to early on, between the police and the minority community, and destroyed some of those false beliefs. So in reality, after the program was implemented, the police viewed the community better and the community viewed the police better, and so it's a win for the community in general. The police learned that the people in the community cared very much about stopping the violence and improving the community and the quality of their life in the community. I think that's something that probably the two messages about how community learns police and their real regard for them and how police can learn that the community also has a stake, has an interest in preserving the community. And the people in the community learned that the police cared. They cared very much about the same thing, namely stopping the violence and improving the quality of life in the community. And it went even further, that when gang members took advantage of the opportunity to put down their guns and stop the shooting, both the police and the community started to see them in a different light. They started to see each other differently. And they started to see each other as rational persons who wanted what everyone wanted, namely a good life and a safe community.
Well, I think a couple things come to mind during that summary, Mr. State's Attorney. And the first one is the importance of the communication strategy that's been established as we set up this program. And in some of the cities that the initiative was not successful, the communication strategy to the different partners in the community really wasn't received well or it wasn't put out there well. And so an important part of a lot of the groundwork that's been going on for a number of months is not just the panel here, but others in the community have tried to explain what's going to be happening and hoping that by doing that and helping the community to understand what's taking place here, that they'll embrace the concept, that they'll understand what their part is to play in the overall initiative, and that it'll increase our chances for success. And the other thing, too, just in regards to your overall summary of what Kennedy really didn't see is being a byproduct of this initiative, which was a better relationship between the community at large and in the police department. I think that's one that would probably be interesting for us to maybe just have a few more minutes of conversation on, because maybe the community as a whole doesn't really experience or understand that level of conversation. It's kind of like right underneath the surface, but there certainly is a lot of discussion on an ongoing basis about the relationship, especially between the minority community and the police department, and how that relationship really is, how it works, how it could be better. And Chief Settings Guard, maybe you could just start us off in this part of the conversation a little bit and just talk about your perceptions of how that communication works, how it maybe could improve a little bit. And maybe you might even want to make some type of a comparison between how you found that relationship with the minority community almost 8 years ago when you came here and now, and is it improving and along those lines?
Thanks, Mayor. Many of the statements that Kennedy made in his book about relationship between the minority community and the police are certainly applicable to Peoria, as they were in Milwaukee in my 26 years there. It's kind of an urban law enforcement phenomenon, I think, that, you know, officers are working in tough inner city neighborhoods day after day, and they see the worst of the community. And they don't have as much contact with the good people in that community as you wish they would. And there's a lot of negative interaction between the officers and members of the community. And Kennedy makes the point, which I had to chew on for a day or two to really give it some thought, is that his perception is that if you ask the community why, the section of the community that may not like the police, why don't you like the police? And the answer, generally speaking, is because the police don't like us. And if you could get the officers in a room and ask them the same question, you'd get the same response. Why don't you trust or why don't you like the community, particularly in an inner city neighborhood, is because they don't like us. And so you have this vicious cycle that needs to be broken. I think we've worked hard, and you know, we've formed a police community relations committee in Peoria again, and we've been working hard to try and restore, repair our relationship with the community. There's still work to be done, but I'm hopeful that this is going to be a you know, kind of a launching point for us to really build a solid relationship. I think where this focused deterrence and the Don't Shoot initiative has a lot of promise is that it's a demonstration by law enforcement that counters the notion that all the police want to do is lock every young black male up and send them to prison. And that point's made in the book, that there are people that believe that's true, that when an officer suits up and comes to work every day, that's his mission. You know, that's what I'm going to do tonight. I'm going to try and lock up as many young black people as I can. And that's not in the officer's mind. And I know I've lived it, but that is a perception. So for many, that's the reality. I think this program is a demonstration by the law enforcement community that that's not our goal, not just police, but prosecuting attorneys, et cetera. Our goal is to stem the violence. And if that means we have to lock someone up, then that's what it means. But we'd much prefer, and the officer on the street would much prefer, that a particular individual would just put his gun down and let's find another way. Let's find another solution. Let's find a new way of life for someone. And that's a better success than prison.
So I know from the elected position every year when it comes to budget time and we talk about your budget, focusing in on your budget, and sometimes there's discussions about your strategies and, you know, community policing versus saturation patrols and all the other different tools that you have. Even though Kennedy really didn't go into a whole lot of detail other than the unintended consequence or unintended, I don't think it was a consequence, it was the unintended positive spin off of this, was that improved relationship. We do the Don't Shoot program. It's successful. We're taking a lot of the guns off the street. We're not using the bad guys aren't using guns to commit these crimes. Do you see that as allowing your officers that are your beat officers that are out there on the street every day, is taking that element out of law enforcement? Does that provide them more time maybe to get out of their cars and to establish those relationships? I mean, you know, I listen to my scanner at night in my office every night, and it just never ceases to amaze me how the officers are literally going from call to call to call. And it's hard for us to sit there and expect these officers to get out of the car and walk a beat like they used to in the old days when there's so many more instances that they have to respond to. It's a hard one to answer, Chief, but I mean, would you suppose that would be a positive byproduct of this, is if the guns are going away, that perhaps that will allow the officers more time to actually establish better lines of communication with the neighborhoods that they're working in?
I think that's a reasonable expectation, and it's what I would expect. We, you know, for every incident where a shot's fired, even if no one is struck, you know, it takes resources to respond to that shot's fired. We're looking for shell casings. We're looking for where the bullets went. You know, we're digging bullets out of walls. We're, you know, photographing. We send a lab unit out. It requires so much resource just to document a shooting incident, even when no one's hit. Now, if you have someone struck and, God forbid, someone killed, the amount of time that it takes from street resources, detective resources, all time that if that shooting doesn't happen in those successful cases where we convince a gang member to put his gun down and that shooting doesn't happen, that's all free time that can be spent preventative patrol, walking the beat, just pulling up to someone who's barbecuing in their yard and getting out and saying hello and introducing yourself. There are lots of proactive community outreaches that can actually be accomplished when we free that time up.
When we talk, you know, as I get out in the community and I talk to people, you know, they ask, you know, well, why can't we have officers walking here and why can't we have officers walking there? And Chief, I think you make a good point. Under the circumstance that's present now with the gun violence, the officers are going from call to call to call during the shift that they work. And so I think that would be a great, I don't know that byproduct is the right term, but that would be a great benefit, that if we could get the guns down, that the police would have more time in the community.
I think that was something that, again, that Kennedy didn't really go into a whole lot of detail on, but I think as we're kind of thinking through this strategy and through some of the things that may happen as a result of that, I'm hoping that that's That's one. Mr. Lewis?
Yes, I think you're going to find that a little bit in the discussion we're going to have about the next chapter, about High Point. We're going to talk a little bit about police-community relations and changes in the police focus once that there's less violence.
Well, we'll just use that as a good segue into the second chapter that we're reading this week, is the chapter entitled High Point, Truth-Telling and Reconciliation. And as you've heard already, again, as a member of our panel every week, is our U.S. Attorney Jim Lewis. And Jim, maybe you can just give us an overview of what happens in this chapter.
Yes, we have today Rob Lang, who is an assistant United States attorney in the Middle District of North Carolina, and he is the person that the Justice Department chooses to teach all the United States attorneys and get them energized on this issue. So he's going to do the same for us today.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's a pleasure to be talking to the citizens of Peoria. I know you're going to have great success there as you roll out this violence reduction strategy.
And we've also got my favorite chapter in the book, which is High Point, Truth-Telling and Reconciliation. I've said to people that if you just read one chapter, this is a chapter to read. But what happens is you read this chapter, you're going to read the whole book because you're going to want to. This chapter tells about the work that was done to reduce drugs and violence in High Point, and Rob Lang was right in the middle of that effort. So let me set the stage a bit for questions about change, results, how do you sustain the change, what were the positive results. This chapter talks about building a team, and we do have a team already here in Peoria, and it talks about focus. It talks about identifying the key drug dealers behind all the trouble and damage in the West End area of High Point, and they actually were able to identify 16 key people. And we have that focus already developed here in Peoria. And this chapter also tells us that when it came time to arrest and prosecute to the fullest and essentially make the message quite clear that there were only four of the 16 that they had to actually arrest, and they found that they could talk to the others. And this chapter does talk also about the community, because the community did not want the trouble, the damage that came with the drug market in the West End. And the community backed law enforcement, and we expect that also in Peoria. So, Rob, let's talk about a couple of things here. You know, there's an arrest of the four key people, if I understand correctly, and then you called in the other people. And I know you've been at a lot of these call-ins, but we haven't, and we haven't done one here yet. The chapter quotes what you said at one of the call-ins, but why don't you just sort of give us all a sense of what are these call-ins actually like?
Well, we've done about 250 call-ins here in the Middle District of North Carolina. Over three U.S. attorneys, our current U.S. Attorney Ripley Rand has continued the strategy, the violence reduction strategy. The call-in is essentially bringing in those identified offenders, members of the groups that are utilizing violence to further criminal activity. Try to find the highest-ranking member of the group if you're doing the gang intervention. In the drug market scenario, we brought those active dealers that were actually out on the corners that were driving that drug market that brought all the disarray and the street robberies and the drug users, the car break-ins, all those things. We brought those folks in after making undercover purchases from them. We did not take warrants out on the lesser dealers. Those four that we had to arrest were folks that decided to continue on with their drug dealing. But we delivered this no violence message to them. And the key in the drug market strategy was that the sanctions were going to be swift and certain. Instead of having to wait 6 months to develop a conspiracy case, or instead of having to go through the probation violation process and get a court date and get a lawyer, we already had a purchase made. We already had it on video. It had already been vetted by the state's attorney. The drugs had already been analyzed. So we told them in uncertain terms that if you go back on the corner, you are going to be immediately arrested. We gave them a line in the sand time that as of the next day, the drug market was going to be closed. That was followed up by this legitimate and structured offer to those individuals, to those 12, that there were alternatives. And that was backed with service representatives, schooling folks, members of the community, talking heads, as Kennedy talks about. And we made that offer them. It's time to stop this. It's time to put your drugs down, quit drawing all this disarray into the community. And the result of that was just simply striking in the West End area. It's been replicated 5 neighborhoods in total in High Point. They've moved from the most violent neighborhood that was plagued by drug market and open-air dealing to the next, proving to the community that this strategy was going to be continued until the violence stopped. So this process and this partnership, it's everything that your state's attorney and your chief and the mayor have talked about. It was this combination of the stern and focused law enforcement message on the actual perpetrators of the drug market, followed up by this resetting of the norms by the community that we love you, we want you back in our community, we want you back as our sons and our nephews and our neighbors, but we can't tolerate this violence that's associated with it. And we think it's the drug market that's drawing the violence, and that's what the data has shown, and that's what the data certainly demonstrated in High Point. And that combination of that dual message, followed up by that legitimate offer and followed up by probation resources and all the resources available in the community, seemed to just a light switch went off in the West End. And an area that had averaged about a homicide or two a year for decades, there has not been a homicide there since 2003. The community is completely changed. Economic development from the city has begun. There's actually some businesses that have reopened in the area, and it is a safe community now. And so that's something that they've maintained and held the ground for almost a decade now in the West End, and as I said earlier, expanded it to several other areas in High Point.
Let's talk a little bit about the benefits. The homicide overall in High Point, has it changed?
Well, we've been working in High Point since 1997. We began working there in the 1998 was sort of our test year. We did the first call-in July of 1998. From 1990 to 1998, they averaged about 16.1 homicides a year. That was when their population was somewhere between 70 and 78,000. From 99 to 2007, the next nine-year period, they averaged about 9.1 homicides per year, and their population grew from 79,000 to 97,000. The last 3 years, last 4 years, from 2008 to 2011, they've had 22 homicides, averaging about 5.5. This year in 2012, they've had 2. They had their second the other night. So the drop and the population has increased since the beginning of this strategy from somewhere around 75,000 to 106,000. So while the raw numbers have decreased from averaging over 16 a year down to almost under 5 a year, the population has increased, you know, some 31,000. So we think that's just a dramatic, the numbers. We put economic numbers at different studies, $8 million in costs, medical expenses, prosecution expenses, jailing expenses, incarceration expenses, of course, the lost economic future income of the victims, the carnage to the families, the social structure of children without fathers in most instances, all those attendant costs. We looked at a number of different studies and came up with an average of $8 million. One study had it at $11 million for a homicide, and another had it at $4 million. So we think we are almost at 100 homicides since the beginning of this, and what we feel the reductions that occurred from those rates as they were in the mid to late 90s as to where they are now. So if you'll think about it, it's what the chief was talking about, allocating resources. Because of the reduced numbers of homicides, the officers and the detectives and the police department have been able to focus on other things, robberies that also plague some of our areas of our community. They have also been able to focus on trying and holding accountable those number of homicides that do occur, being able to follow up this promise that if you do X, we will do Y. And it's reduced those number of incidents so that we have additional resources to focus on those high-rate offenders or those groups that are using violence to further their criminal activity, or those drug dealers that are drawing that kind of behavior into the neighborhood. So it's across the board. And what our police department learned through all this is that they could become more proactive as opposed to reactive. We also learned as prosecutors in state and federal that our law enforcement folks could finish running the race, have process improvements, do better crime scene work, do the follow-up interviews necessary, document the reports and their activities in a more focused fashion on those individuals that we identified that were driving the violence. Not in every case. We didn't ask them to do every case, just on those that we'd identified through thorough research. So the police department began to be more proactive instead of reactive, taking the message to the street, identifying a group of young individuals that were on the tipping point of beginning maybe a robbery spree or were involved in a drive-by shooting, taking this call in theory and taking it out to the street, talking to their mothers, bringing trusted community folks and clergy and service providers and probation officers with them so they could get into the door to some of the homes and talk to these young folks. And most of the time, they're pretty young. And they began to experiment with that kind of intervention, that kind of prevention work, so much so that about 5 years ago, the police department in High Point, they changed their traditional criminal investigations division. They changed the name of it, and they changed it to Major Crimes Prevention and Deterrence. And that's a complete flip of the standard law enforcement response that we react, we investigate, we arrest, we clear the case, and we turn it over to the prosecutors. This was just a complete paradigm flip where they now began to think that, well, we're always going to investigate, and they're always going to follow through, and they do that very, very, very well. But now let's think about what we know. We know where it's going to happen. We generally know who's going to do it. Why don't we go out in front of that and talk about that? We had learned in the gang, and I understand Peoria, that's what you're looking at, this gang group dynamic. We had learned that many times a shooting or a major incident would cause a retaliation from the other group that they're having a beef with or having the dispute. And by simply going out and using the intel that they had already developed, they could go out to that group that was victimized, let them know at an early time, at an early stage of the investigation, we have this in hand. We know you're beefing with those fellas that wear blue rags. If you take anything into your hands, we are going to respond on you like you've never seen. This investigation will be cleared. And what it did is stop that back and forth between the groups that just creates havoc in the community, makes everyone walk around with armed, and creates just, you know, the potential for disaster in almost every dispute out there on the street. So that, in combination with what they learned in the drug markets, that the community was actually interested and wanted to be part of this strategy and wanted to help craft a solution to bring back its young men into the fold. And it was just an absolutely powerful voice going out in all directions.
I've heard from the minister of the church in the West End. Would you talk about what actually happened for that church?
Absolutely. The English Road Baptist Church, Reverend Jim Summey, who had been there for 17 years, he had been asking the police department to respond in the West End community for years. The police didn't know what to do. They sent the units out there. They responded to the calls in a timely manner. But it was just the community was plagued with drug dealers, prostitution, all those things. Once Summey was engaged in this strategy, he tells stories about after it happened in May of 2003, when the initial call-in of the drug market invention occurred, in his June Bible school that year, he talks about that overhearing kids in the community saying it was okay to walk home now. It was okay to play outside. And he noticed the number of neighborhood children that attended his Bible school had increased dramatically. Normally, no one from the neighborhood came. It was from members that were outside the neighborhood. So that it's been a complete change in that community, led by Jim Summey and his church there. They had been providing services, food, clothing, and faith-based services. He'd been burying those over there that couldn't afford it for years. So he had a lot of credibility in the community, but it was that combination of his credibility and his moral voice from the community in combination with that law enforcement research, the undercover buys, and that fair and balanced message on the focused audience, on those that are really doing the problem, that changed the way. So the West End's a different place now.
Talk to us a little bit about High Point. It's famous for the furniture market, and people were afraid that the furniture market was going to leave for Las Vegas. Tell us about the economics of the city.
Yeah, High Point's an interesting city. It has a number of furniture manufacturers that are located there. The furniture market occurs twice a year in High Point, in the fall and the spring. It's one of the big economic drivers of this entire area, all the things attended to the furniture industry. Well, a number of years ago, Las Vegas came out with a competing furniture market, and everyone was petrified that Las Vegas market would eradicate the High Point market. And that has not been the case. One of the marketing strategies that the Chamber of Commerce and the city of High Point have done so well is marketing the safety of High Point. It's the safest city in North Carolina. And they have marketed it that way, and the furniture market is still thriving, and they have one this October. Another one is coming up. The economic development has continued. They market crime numbers, the violent crime numbers. Recently, Ralph Lauren was opening up a new call center and looking at a number of areas across the country as to where to locate that call center. When they sent a team to High Point to investigate the potential for relocating their call center and what type of local incentives would be available, One of the last stops at the city manager's request was to go to interview the chief of police. And the former chief of police, Chief Jim Failey, talked to them about what his philosophy is and why High Point's so safe and why it's an area where a business would want to relocate because of this newfound friendship with the community and these relationships that had been forged through these violence reduction strategies. So it ended up being one of the key points in Ralph Lauren selecting High Point as the place to locate its new center, and brought 500 jobs to this area, which in this day and age is certainly nothing to sneeze about.
And Rob, just real quick, you've got this in High Point, but you've got it in a number of other places in your district, don't you?
Yes, sir. We have 10 of these violence reduction sites in operation inside the Middle District, some in counties, some in small cities, some in larger cities. We have two on deck. We're working on our research to pinpoint which strategy, whether it's the gang group, the chronic offender, the drug market, domestic violence, or the robbery strategy, all versions of David Kennedy's focused deterrence that can be tweaked and using the same basic partners and the same basic call-in structure to attack and pinpoint the area of violence that seems to be plaguing your community. So we've had great success here. We've had 60% reductions in Cabarrus County, a county of 160,000 since 2007. It's a bedroom community of Charlotte, North Carolina, and dramatic reductions in their Part 1 crime. We've had 40% reductions in Winston-Salem, 35% reductions in Greensboro. We've had reductions literally in every city or county that we've tried this in. Some places better, some places better than others, but wherever we try it, it seems to do well. So. And it seems to be able to be sustained. In High Point, we've had 3 police chiefs, city council changes every 2 years, 3 district attorneys, 3 U.S. attorneys, and 2 interim U.S. attorneys. Throughout all that time, we've been able to keep our partnerships strong, to keep the strategy strong. And that's the beauty of this strategy, that it never ends.
I saw you energize a room full of U.S. attorneys, and you've energized us today, and you've energized the listeners. We may bring you back to talk to our office and talk to some other people. But for today, you've done us a great deal of good, and we thank you very much for it.
Well, thank you, and I thank my good friend Tate Chambers up there. He's been very helpful to me. when he was national chair of this particular strategy. So thank you very much, Jim, and your great panel up there.
Thank you.
Well, we'd like to thank Rob for participating in bringing a lot of this more into focus for us. And I'll tell you, that was very encouraging for me to hear, especially a lot of the similarities between High Point, not only in their population, but where their homicide numbers were and where they've brought them to over the last 14 years, 15 years or so. But also the encouraging thing for those people that are out there saying, you know, yeah, this is just a one and done. You guys are probably just going to do this, and then next year it's going to be on to the next thing. What we just heard, I mean, with empirical evidence, is that this is something that is sustainable over long periods of time. The community has to stay focused on it. But this is something, a strategy that we can use for a long time that could drastically reduce those violent crimes. And, you know, how awesome would that be if we could be like High Point was and that Peoria could use this as a marketing tool in the state to say Peoria is the safest community in Illinois? We would like to just remind everybody that this is the third week of our review of David Kennedy's book, Don't Shoot. We're going to come back here in a few minutes and talk about the next chapter, building out to, and also bring in another national guest, Ed McGarrell. Well, the third chapter that we're reading this week is building out to Mr. State's Attorney. Maybe you could give us a quick overview of that chapter before we bring in Mr. McGarrell.
Thanks. In this chapter, Kennedy discusses his efforts after High Point to continue spreading his focused deterrence strategy across the nation. He continues to encounter many of the same problems, though, that he faced before. Law enforcement who did not understand the strategy and thought the entire program was hug-a-thug. And I think it's important that we send that message. This is not about hug-a-thug. This is instead focused deterrence, which is a different concept. Also, communities who thought their community was unique, and although it may have worked elsewhere, it would not work in their community because of various reasons. One, their problem they thought was more serious, or they thought their gang members were more violent, and so on. Also, people who would not leave their egos at the door and focus instead on the community good of their community. He continues to overcome those problems, and David Kennedy does throughout, as you can tell by reading the book. He takes approaches that when he encounters difficulties, he learns and determines strategy to overcome those problems. And he does that with the same essential elements which make the strategy work, namely, support the moral voice of the community, create strong partnerships between the police and the community, working the call-ins, keeping their word to gang members who agreed to put their guns down, and keeping their promise to aggressively prosecute those gang members who did not. In other words, David focuses on that as part of the message that we must continue to implement the strategy as it's worked. I'd like now to welcome our national guest, Ed McGarrell. Ed is a director and the professor at the Michigan State University School of Criminal Justice. He is well known and one of the leading authorities on focused deterrence, the concept that we intend to discuss this morning and that is part of the book, Don't Shoot, written by David Kennedy. Ed is well known in the United States and understands why focused deterrence works and why in some instances it may not work. Today, Ed is joining us from public radio station WKAR on the campus of Michigan State University. Welcome, Ed.
Well, thank you, Jerry. Happy to be here.
In your work, you have used the term power few. Could you explain a little bit about what that is and what it means?
Sure, Jerry. The term power few was coined by a criminologist named Larry Sherman. And what Larry pointed out was that the degree and the extent to which violence is highly concentrated. And what we mean by that is that a very small proportion of people, places, and groups are responsible for nearly all the violence that affects a community like Peoria and other areas of the country. To give you a sense of that, about 6 to 8% of the population is responsible for about 60 to 70% of crime and violence. And the more serious crime, the more violent crime, that concentration is even more pronounced. Another way to look at this is about 3 to 5% of the addresses. So you just think about all the street addresses in a community like Peoria, that typically you'll find about 3 to 5% of those addresses are responsible for over half the calls for service to the police. And finally, we see that a small number of groups, and we sometimes refer to these as violent street groups, but the members of these violent street groups that are a very small proportion of the population can be responsible for up to 80% of the homicides that occur. So the idea of the power few is to think about this level of concentration and then gear our enforcement and intervention and prevention strategies and resources to concentrate on that power few.
After you've identified the population, in other words, it appears that this allows you to identify and focus on the most violent offender or the more serious offender. That'd be a fair kind of summary of where we are?
Yeah, it's a good summary, and I would add one additional qualification. Because the criminal justice system, police, prosecutors historically, attempt to focus on that small group of chronic violent repeat offenders. The other part of this is realizing that they're connected to other individuals that may not have reached that serious degree of offending. And if we can identify that network of individuals, then we can try to have an influence on their behavior with the goal of preventing them from becoming the next group of serious chronic offenders.
You mentioned that that's representative of Peoria in most communities. Help me understand why you can say Peoria would fit within that group of other cities that share that similar, apparently, that's a similar characteristic of all communities.
Well, Jerry, you're absolutely right in asking the question. And certainly I would expect, that on some of those figures I was quoting, there'll be some variation in a community like Peoria. So, it may not be 5% of the street blocks. It may be 8%. It may be 3%. But what we've seen is this continued pattern, particularly when we talk about the most violent crime. And I think, if you think about this, the good news is that most of our citizens in our communities, do not become involved in illegally carrying guns, illegally using those guns in that highest level of violent crime. The reality is that it is very, very concentrated. One of the things that we advocate that's become part of the focused deterrence approach is to have an analytical component within each community to look specifically at those patterns to try to understand, well, who among the population is involved in the violence? Who are they associated with that puts them at risk of becoming involved in violence? Where is it occurring? What do these hot spots look like? And so while I would expect that a community like Peoria will have, will have its own flavor and character, but I think by looking across the country, as we've done in Project Safe Neighborhoods and working with a large number of cities that are affected by a violent crime problem, these patterns recur enough that you can have a degree of confidence that as you look carefully at the data and the crime patterns within the city, that something along the lines of these patterns that I've described are likely to hold true. And then the strategies will be targeted at the specific picture that emerges for Peoria.
Well, given what you've described, this small proportion of people, if that's true, then what law enforcement strategies seem to work to address this most violent offender or the violent crime problem?
Certainly when a homicide, a shooting, an armed robbery occurs within a community, and I'm sure this is true of Peoria, that's going to become a high priority for the police, and then when arrests are made for the prosecutor's office. You know, in effect, that's what police and prosecutors do very well. You know, they set their priorities, they conduct their investigations, they make arrests as appropriate, and they prosecute when the evidence dictates. What the focused deterrence strategy attempts to do is to build on that foundation, but move it one more level, and that is to try to influence those other individuals who may not have reached that level of seriousness, but that are, who are at high risk of becoming involved in violence, in some of the retaliatory violence that can occur, and some of the other behaviors that can have a spillover effect.
What are some of the characteristics of effective implementation of a focused deterrence program?
What we found is the partnerships become absolutely critical. You know, we haven't seen this work when it's a single entity. You know, it's not the local police department alone. It's not the U.S. Attorney's Office alone. But it's the combination of local and federal law enforcement, local and federal prosecution, bringing in probation and parole, and Department of Corrections. So those are the key criminal justice actors. But then the partnerships go beyond that to reach out to the social services community. And this can be both formal services that exist within a community like Peoria. It can also be informal services. There have been some ex-offender mentoring groups and faith-based leaders that have been critical. And then to reach out to the broader community.
Ed, you talk about two lists, the A list and the B list. And as I understand it, on the A list are those that are the most violent that must go to prison. Those are the individuals that we seek to incarcerate. But then the B list includes those that are less violent that we seek to send a consequential message to. Is that a fair summary of the distinction between the two lists?
That's exactly where we are and how this strategy plays out. So then, and that's where this goes beyond kind of traditional enforcement activity. You know, we've always hoped that the word would get out to others that, you know, you don't want to go down this path. But what's different about this strategy is this becomes an explicit part of the strategy. And this concept of focused deterrence is we need to communicate directly to these other at-risk individuals who, absent an intervention, are likely to become the future chronic and violent offenders, the B-listers.
Yes.
Individuals who we fear are headed towards violence based on their behavior and based on their associations, but who've not reached that stage. And these are the persons that are invited or ordered into one of these call-in meetings.
Is the call-in to those that are on the B-list that are thought to be less violent than those on the A-list? Fair statement?
That's correct.
Help me understand a call-in, Ed.
Well, the call-in, and this is the concept that David Kennedy developed initially in Boston and then working with officials in High Point. Some of your other guests have been involved in the development of these call-in meetings. But it's really a pretty simple idea. If we want to communicate a deterrent message, what better way than bringing the individuals that we fear are at risk of becoming involved in this violence into a face-to-face meeting for a direct delivery of this meeting. And so in these call-in meetings, so the background work has been done by the police and prosecutors. They've distinguished, you know, these violent street groups and then made they've identified the violent street groups and then identified the A-listers that are subject to traditional prosecution and the B-listers, again, those individuals at risk. It's those B-listers that are then invited or, in the case of a probationer and parolee, maybe ordered by their parole officer or probation officer to attend one of these meetings. At the meeting, they're going to hear a message delivered by both criminal justice officials as well as community members, and it really becomes a five-prong message. The first is a unified message from police, prosecution, social service, other city leaders, community leaders that we're tired of the violence. The second point is the reason you're here is because the kind of behaviors that you're involved in, the kind of associations that you're keeping put you at risk for either becoming involved in violence as an offender, like some of your buddies, or as a victim. And we're here to offer you a choice. And the choice is, if you continue in these types of behaviors and these types of associations, then the criminal justice officials, the police, the prosecutors, are going to do everything within their power to remove you from the community and to give you a new address within a correctional facility. The second option, and the one that we all prefer that you would take, is to get out of this business, to not become further involved in criminal activity, in illegal gun carrying. At this point, what will typically happen in one of these call-in meetings is there'll be an offer of support, that if you choose to make what we consider the right decision, there are people here that will work with you. And finally, the fifth aspect of the call-in is an expression of the moral voice of the community. And this is when residents of the local neighborhoods, neighborhood leaders, will simply say, you know, we're tired of the violence. The violence has to stop. Some of the powerful voices in one of these call-in meetings that I observed was from a funeral director who got up and talked about how tired he was of having young homicide victims that unfortunately needed his services. But the community voice essentially is expressed, you know, is communicating that message that the violence is wrong, it must end, but we're here to work with you and we're here to support you.
As part of that partnership, Ed, you know, we talk about the community and the community at large. And what message do we send as to how they can become involved and what they can do to help that, you know, those members of the community that are not directly involved in the violence?
And I think that that's a good question. And one of the things that we've found is there's a timing issue here. I have observed some communities where there's a degree of fear of becoming involved among some community members. So sometimes that is an issue that needs to be addressed. But more commonly, I think when the connection is made with neighborhood leaders and citizens is that this focused deterrence model becomes attractive because it's seen as having both, there's a logic here that promises to be effective, but it's also seen as fair. There's something fundamentally fair about this process that's in place that I think is very attractive.
From a fairness standpoint, they've been given the opportunity to make the choice. What most people in programs like this, you know, there's always the other side of the coin. What are some of the things that we've talked about, the components that lead to success? What are some of the components, or what are some of the problems that have been found to be unsuccessful?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Looking at a wide variety of communities across the country, you know, there are some instances where what I would describe is kind of a failure of implementation. I haven't seen this model effectively implemented and sustained where I've not seen an impact on levels of violence. What we have seen are problems in effectively implementing the model. And I think that failure in implementation comes from several different problems or challenges that can emerge. The first actually relates back to the question you asked me. You know, why would you think these patterns fit within Peoria? And that's an important question because it is important to do the analysis to understand what's driving violence in Peoria. Because while I think those overall patterns will fit, when you drill down to what's driving violence today on the streets, there can be these different dynamics. So in some cases, it may be violence associated with a drug market. In other cases, it's, you know, particular gangs or these street groups that we've talked about. In some communities, you know, there'll be a rash of drug robberies And those are oftentimes lead to this retaliatory violence. So it's important to have a clear diagnosis of what's driving the violence within the community.
Any other problems that you're aware of, Ed, that have been thought to be the reasons for the failure?
I think those are the key ones. In the call-in meeting itself, I think it becomes very important to remember the importance of respect among the individuals that we bring into these meetings, and that oftentimes these are individuals from disadvantaged backgrounds where there's almost a heightened level of concern about respect.
Sure. And the importance of respect seems to be a real important message that has to be sent if we are to anticipate that the individuals that are brought in at the call-in are going to demonstrate respect back.
You have a choice to make. If you make one choice, here are the consequences. If you make another choice, we're here to support you. We hope you'll make the right choice.
Ed, that's been a very powerful message. We're grateful for your participation, and we appreciate your time.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to observing, if from a distance, how this continues to develop, and I applaud the efforts of Peoria to make this happen.
Your interest is welcome. Thank you very much.
Well, this hour really goes fast discussing the different aspects of David Kennedy's book, and we'd like to thank our panelists again this week. Of course, our U.S. Attorney, Jim Lewis, our State's Attorney, Jerry Brady, Police Chief Steve Settingsguard, the Sheriff, Sheriff Mike McCoy. We'd also like to thank Rob Lang, who came to us from High Point, North Carolina. He's the Assistant U.S. Attorney over there, and also Ed McCarroll from Michigan State. It was a very fascinating book, and Jim, I can see, as you said, and as I've read the book too, this is one of my favorite chapters of the whole book, and I hope the listening audience agreed. So next week's going to be the last week. David Kennedy will be here in the WCBU studios with us in person. We're really excited to have him coming to Peoria for a few days next week. Please, everyone, mark your calendars that next Wednesday, the 29th, David will be at Riverside Church in a community forum, an opportunity for everyone to get to meet him and listen to him and really find out a lot more personal feelings from David Kennedy and how really he spent the last several decades working toward a solution to these very serious problems. And we'd also like to remind everybody to go to the website don'tshootpeoria.com and look at the information there. There's some interactive pieces, some parts where you can find out other things that are going on in the community. And I really do have to, again, at the end of this show, thank Tanya Kuntz, the news director here at WCBU, for allowing us this platform to discuss this very important community initiative.
You've been listening to the third Peoria Reads Don't Shoot Roundtable series on WCBU. I'm Tanya Kuntz. Peoria Mayor Jim Artis, Peoria County State's Attorney Jerry Brady, U.S. Attorney Jim Lewis, and Peoria Police Chief Steve Settingsguard were our panelists for this show. The show was produced by WCBU Operations Manager Daryl Scott and Assistant U.S. Attorney Tate Chambers. Technical assistance for the show comes from WKAR in East Lansing, Michigan, and WFDD in Winston-Salem. Please join us next week for a review and discussion of pages 207 through 286 of David Kennedy's book, Don't Shoot. Again, next week, we'll be covering pages 207 to 286. This Don't Shoot Peoria Reads Roundtable show airs again Sunday at 3 o'clock here on Peoria Public Radio and can also be found on our website, wcbufm.org.